not sure good ideas, but a little bit of a queasy feeling. Rick McGee. I'm here at Northwestern. And as I'm listening, my interest is really in the development of young scientists and development of scientific talent. So as I'm certainly not an expert in science or team science, but I'm thinking about and listening to all this is that these are really the environments in which our young scientists are learning to be scientists. So, for example, graduate students, postdocs. So on the one hand, if they're involved, if these become the training and development environments that they're in, the good news is they're kind of experiencing the environment that they're going to be, you know, going to be working in. But the queasy feeling started to come actually looking at Joanne at your last cartoon, you know, and recognizing all of a sudden one of the unintended consequences of this. Yeah, and I think even Marshall, when you forgot the individual, you know, goals of the people, that, you know, there's some real risks here potentially that I think the community needs to think about as you're looking at the science. So in these more complex programs that take a lot to put together, you know, and are very highly structured and highly prescribed, the capacity for young scientists to experience the creativity, the let me try this. Let me come up with a new idea, which is already challenged in our regular system where this, we're calling it training, but it's really, it's work. You know, it's really, you know, can you get AIM 3 done so we can get the new grant so my small business can keep operating? I have some real concerns potentially that the risks of the students losing this opportunity to really develop as scientists could be escalating in, you know, in this environment of big and team science. I'd be curious if other people have any thoughts on that.
In one lab where I was observing that I think really does this very, very well, their concern, how they trained scientists was they spent time in their own lab, but they had to go spend time in another discipline's lab. But of course, then that drew their attention away from building their own disciplinary focus and expertise. And that was their big question. We believe this is better because it's more collaborative, it has more dialogue, we're creating and innovating new things, but we're also pulling away from the disciplinary focus. And they decided that it was in their best interest to create interdisciplinary or multidisciplinary students rather than single disciplinary students. But that was the aim of that particular team, right. And not the institutional focus.
Right.
And to me, those people were, I'm sorry, but you can just see if someone's happy or not at work. Those people were happy. Mm-hmm. Those people were talking. The students were engaged. They asked intriguing questions, which I didn't always see in other places. And so they realized that trade-off, and they were very happy with it. But institutionally, it hasn't caught on.
And I can just, you know, and I've got a poster later. We've actually studied co-mentoring as a contrast to typical single mentoring. And done right, it has extremely powerful, positive impact done prospectively and consciously. But again, I think as even your diagram pointed out, that's probably not the norm of what's happening in most cases. But it takes a mentor with real insight and energy to actually create that atmosphere as opposed to how do we get this project done again with all the, you know, difficulties of communications.
And the mentor in this case is multidisciplinary.
Right.
Chemist, but he studies cancer in chickens.
Yeah.
And with the vet school.
Yeah.
And so that was the model that he learned by and has been very successful for him.
Yeah.
And so he is really modeling that for his students. And it just the production from that group is really outstanding.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're also creating scientists who stay in the science field, mm-hmm. rather than scientists who go do something else.
Yeah. In terms of what the multi-team system model would imply, it implies that you need to bring those goals into alignment so that the individual goals are aligned with being able to meet the goals up the process. And that's not something you do at a distance, and it's not something you just do once. You know, it's an interactive process all the way through. One of the things we found on the Virtual Worlds Observatory project is it was very important for the PIs to sit in on those weekly meetings. The graduate students take the lead, but we sit in because it's so important for them to see how our thought processes work and so on.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, thanks.
Jack Pincus with Silicon Technologies. My question is for Linus. I actually have two questions. First, your results are very interesting in the contrast between same discipline, different discipline. Were you able to tease out whether some of the results that you saw might be due to differences in how the applications were reviewed, differences in how panels were assembled and how they were instructed to review the applications?
Very good question. We're actually working, one of the doctoral students, Kaisa, is working on precisely that issue because there are different ways of evaluating the grants in different grant agencies. So that's exactly what we're working on, but I didn't have anything to present.
That would be very interesting. Secondly, with respect to the high success rate in commercial projects, to what extent might that be influenced to the fact that in commercial projects, there are normally extensive discussions between the PI and the company framing the project before a proposal is submitted?
I think that's true, and I never meant to say that this is, they have a higher success rate precisely because of that reason, that Google, for example, emailed you one of my mentors and asked them if you're interested in doing a collaboration together. So I think that's precisely what's happening. But it's just to say that what happens with corporations is that they typically fund disciplinary research. I don't want to say too much about that kind of based on where they compare some, but it's a good question.
Hi, I'm John Sexton from the Vanderbilt University Institute of Imaging Science. And I just recently found out about the science of team science research field, but I've just spent the past 5.5 years or so living in the situation that Joanne described. And you pretty much nailed it. there were a lot of things that we were trying there at the Imaging Institute. It's very interdisciplinary. It's relatively new. We had a little bit of the buy versus make problem, and Vanderbilt decided to basically bring in a bunch of experts and start a new imaging institute and bring in a bunch of other people and sort of grow. And so we experienced a lot of challenges related to integrating a bunch of new people, new building, new equipment, new ideas, breaking it out into teams, figuring out what worked and what didn't. And basically, I just kind of wanted to say that I have some experience with that as a student who just finished. And if anybody is interested in talking to somebody who's recently been involved in these situations, I'd be happy to talk about that. I can't talk about it all right now. But some of the stuff that I felt like we did that really worked was when we did sort of break up into the smaller teams with very specifically defined goals. And it wasn't focused so much on this is my discipline or this is your discipline or so much like these are the problems that can result from us not speaking the same language. The times when we were successful, it was always when we came together and said, this is the problem we need to solve. Here's what I can contribute, here's what you can contribute. And everybody's contributions were made to feel valuable. I think a lot of times you sort of bring a group together under the assumption that there's going to be confusion or maybe disagreement or difficulty. And the times when we didn't sort of address that and just sort of said, this is a problem that we need to solve. We're all smart. We have good resources. Let's just solve the problem. We did solve the problem, and sometimes quite quickly. And other times, we would sort of theorize and say, well, what if this and what if that? And we would kind of get stuck in the analysis paralysis mode where the problem at hand would sort of be ignored in favor of, you know, theoretical things that may or may not happen down the road. And in fact, we never even got to that point because the core problem was never addressed. And so I'm only here because I went through that experience and thought there has got to be a better way to do team science and to understand it. And I'm at this conference out of curiosity. I don't know anybody here really, aside from a few of you that I've emailed and met last night. I'm very interested in learning more and talking to people and sharing experiences. So I think this is wonderful. And I'm very happy to be absorbing as much as I can. So if I can be of help to anybody providing stories or things, please find me. Thanks.
Brian Butler at the University of Pittsburgh. And I have a specific question for Scott about something you said, but then it ties into a larger question that I guess I'd like to ask the whole panel. So the specific question is, you asserted that research teams are not likely to be characterized well by recognition prime decision making, but rather are more reflective and deliberative in their decision making. And I was curious, is that how we'd like to think that it works, or is there empirical evidence that that actually occurs that way? And then the larger question that really goes to is, we've talked a lot about how complicated this is, this thing called team science. And I was curious if in either in your experience, Scott, or during the studies you've done, have you seen patterns or general techniques of how people learn how to do this? And so not so much how they learn how to do the science task, but how they learn how to construct teams and manage them and do these things, and what triggers that learning versus when they're doing it rote or whether they're bringing it from their experience as a graduate student. So the processes by which the teams learn how to solve these problems, again, as opposed to learning how to do the science. And so anything you could say about that?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, that's why I said during my discussion of scientific teams that I think they kind of go back and forth between being, you know, using recognition prime decision making. I mean, I know I do when I look at a printout, you know, a statistical analysis. I don't think about it. But I think as you're formulating the project and you're trying to figure out ways to get data and that thing the longer term, I think it is a lot more deliberative and more kind of problem solving. So it may well be that a lot of team science is more like action teams than I assumed. In the team area, there's, as Steve said earlier, there's kind of a distinction between two kinds of work, task work and teamwork. And teamwork explicitly refers to how do you learn, you know, to operate as a team. And there's quite a bit of literature, really. I mean, a lot of it by Steve and Eduardo Salas and people down at Central Florida, but there's a lot from other places, too, that really have good lessons that I think can be drawn on. We didn't have this body of knowledge 15 years ago when I first started studying groups in information technology, but it's really developed rather impressively over the past 15 years, almost to a point where I can say a lot of those problems you referred to have sort of been solved, you know, and what we need to do is to figure out how it transfers from military, crew, cockpit situations into science situations. Some of it will be easy to transfer, but some of it will be a lot harder. Others?
I would say that the groups that do it really well, they care less about what others think of them. Their ego is less externally oriented about how others in the institution or others in their discipline are going to perceive what they do, and they're focused on really doing good team science, regardless of what others, their comparable others, might think or do. I would say that's one thing, that the ego needs are far fewer and less obvious. And I think that allows that more collaborative spirit to develop and remain. So that's a kind of personality trait. I don't think we can screen all team scientists on all personality traits. I'm not advocating that, but we might get to a pretty small pool if we figure out what that is. But there is just less concern. And I guess the other thing I would say is that I see a real difference in different shops, different groups that use collective language, we, us, not I. So when I get started by the principal investigators, I remains the dominant language, and it starts to separate people immediately. But the successful ones really talk about the team, we did this, we're going to do this, really a collective kind of identity that then continues to spread.
And I'd be really curious to know things like, can you ask the people you're interacting with that do that well, that use the we, you know, is that something they're aware that they're doing and that they figured out because they screwed it up?
Oh.
Or is it because something that they kind of accidentally did? You know, so where did that technique come from is kind of the question.
I don't know, but I'll ask him.
I'm Paul Edwards from the University of Michigan. I just wanted to amplify some things that Jonathan pointed out. I work with a research group that's in four locations and has about a dozen members, and we study several large scientific cyber infrastructure projects that are also widely distributed with many members and work across time zones and across continents. And one of the things that has become really clear to us is the importance of rhythm in their work. So somebody mentioned a weekly meeting a little while ago, and you know, every professor in the room knows how having the class schedule that you end up with in a semester can either make your life or break your life. You know, if you have back-to-back classes on a day, it can just be horrible. And the rhythms of collaborative work, especially distributed work, are really important in making things successful. I mean, we learned this partly from some of the teams that we studied, who have a weekly conference call that always happens, even if there are only two people on the call. They just maintain it as a rigid rule that they will always have an open line, and sometimes they do nothing. They don't even talk, but the line is open, and if someone has something to say, they can say it. But it, you know, we noticed that in our own work process, that was really driving us. We started doing this weekly meeting and then began to have to see that everyone was doing all their work in the 3 hours before the call started. So then trying to find ways to make a rhythm that would take us outside that kind of drivenness by the moment of the meeting. That's it.
Yeah, thanks. I have a quick response. Something that I didn't go into, which is, I think, related to this point of synchrony and timing and rhythm, is that the list that I put up is a bunch of small things, but over time, small things accumulate into bigger things. So on a given week, you may not notice any of those things, the semester, the teaching load, the training, the writing a grant, et cetera. But over the course of 1, 2, 3 years, all these little institutional differences really start to mount. And as they start to mount, your expectations about what you can do in the collaboration start to go down. And so, in a way, this is kind of a cyclical rhythm of life, rhythm of doing the work that isn't always kind of in the conscious or front of mind, but it's something that just kind of comes up and nags at you, and then 6 months in, you're like, how come this distributed project's completed X, but the local project with my colleague down the hall is X plus one? And so, over time, X plus one becomes X plus two, X plus three, and then by the end of the three-year grant, you're like, wow, I did nothing here and a ton here. Where did it all go? And so we're really trying to get underneath what are some of these things that cause this synchronization and this rhythm of life to unravel over time.
You know, one additional way to look at what you're doing is to think of it in terms of ritual. If you look at most meetings, face-to-face meetings, there's an awful lot of things that we do ritualistically or formulaically. If you know, it gets a little depressing if you actually look at it hard. But those rituals are so important because they give a structure to your life. And those kinds of meetings, if you can set them up, and I think you can do that just as easily in a distributed group, if you set it up and you really abide by it, it can provide a really interesting thing. Anthropologists, I think, would say it meets some kind of deeper need we have. So.